Sunday after Sunday, I have forgotten something, and today I want to make up for that. Jim Rattigan, Jim Kelly, Chris Kelly, Peggy Lottie are all present this morning, and I want to thank them at last for the splendid sermons they preached while I was out of this pulpit. Please forgive me for being so tardy. I begin with a verse. See if you recognize it. The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot, and whether pigs have wings. If you remember a book called Through the Looking Glass, and Lewis Carroll's funny little nonsense poem about the walrus and the carpenter, you know that when the walrus said those things, he was really just trying to distract some little oysters until he could start eating them. He didn't mean anything by what he was saying. It was done only to dazzle and distract and to profit him. Just hollow rhetoric. And that's the kind of rhetoric the Apostle Paul has in mind at the beginning of the great 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians when he says, "If I speak with the eloquence of men and of angels, but have no love, I am no more than a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal." The word Paul used for love was agape. We spent last Sunday defining it to mean concern and caring, a determination to do the right and decent thing by people, even the ones we don't like. So what he says in that opening line is that talk without caring is nothing more than noise, rhetoric that is only racket. The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things. The walrus was clever and inventive. He has no love behind his speech, but he has a rich variety of topics: shoes, ships, sealing wax, cabbages, kings, all nonsense, all meant to hide the fact that what he says has nothing to do with his real motives. Like some of us in politics and some of us who preach, and some of us who sell, he shapes language to take advantage of an audience. This is the rhetoric without love that Paul says is finally worth nothing. But it's only one kind of loveless speech. There are others. That man or woman, for example, in the board or business meeting, who drones on and on, shamelessly stealing everyone else's precious time, through a tedious hour, for a report that requires and deserves only 5 minutes, an injury done to all the rest of us by one who loves not us, but himself, the sound of his own voice, the control she has for as long as she can stretch it. That is a form of inadequate caring. Even in the most intimate social settings, we may speak without love for those who invited us. I was in a living room not so long ago with no one from this church, I hasten to add. And there were two other men present who illustrated what I'm talking about. One of them was terribly insecure, but he wanted approval, as we all do. And so he kept telling us stories of where he had been and the great sights he had seen and how he had been honored in this place or that, monopolizing the evening. He used far too many superlatives, always a sign of insecurity, until finally none of them meant anything because he had cheapened the currency. He kept going into infinite detail about things no one cared to hear, and he was intelligent enough to know, even as he talked, that we were not interested. So he used even more superlatives to force excitement upon us. He did not know how to quit, because deep inside, he never quite believed that he was making the impression he wanted to make, so he just lurched desperately on. The host, an old friend, sat quietly as usual, feeling no need to dazzle us with stories, but he noticed when someone needed something, and his face, even his movements, spoke the quiet language of genuine concern. He felt no compulsion to clash verbal symbols together, because it didn't matter whether we were paying attention to him all the time. Consequently, when he did speak, there was sudden, respectful attention, and his words carried weight and power. He showed love instead of talking about it. But even if he had talked about love and talked well, it would not have been the same as a demonstration. As I meant to suggest by the title of this sermon, talk can easily create a substitute world for the one we should be living in, but which is too costly for us. No one ever put that idea more succinctly than Jesus did when he said once, "What is the point of calling me Lord, Lord, without doing what I tell you to do? Flattery without conviction? Respect without response?" What Jesus said in shorthand, using only two words where I must now use a dozen, is that pious talk, religious vocabulary are not in themselves worth anything. The truly eloquent may hardly speak at all, but they are busy doing something. I had forgotten where I found my title, but I realized this morning that it must have stuck in my memory from a section in a book by Houston Smith called The Religions of Man. He writes about how powerful language has been in the world's history, but equally how dangerous. Words, he says, can build up a kind of substitute world that dilutes the intensity of direct experience. A world that is warmed over when not downright fraudulent. A person can say the right things about a painting without having the slightest trace of an aesthetic experience. A woman can fool herself into thinking she loves her child simply because she addresses it with words of endearment. A nation can assume that the addition of the words "under God" to its pledge of allegiance gives evidence that its citizens actually believe in God, whereas all it really proves is that they believe in believing in God. The carpenter's son understood this 2,000 years before Houston Smith. "It is not everyone who keeps saying to me, 'Lord, Lord,' who will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who actually does my Father's will." We can find this use of language to create a substitute world everywhere we look. We use the language of love to hide the fact that we are not loving. We use the words of honesty to cover the fact that we are planning to cheat. We recite in a pious sing-song voice the rhetoric of religion to hide even from ourselves the fact that religion has not made an ounce of difference in our lives, and that we profess it only for some profit or comfort to ourselves. We live in a huge laboratory where we can demonstrate every day how language takes the place of action because it comes so easily and costs so little. Houston Smith, in the book I quoted a moment ago, was talking in that place about Zen Buddhism, which stresses the limitations of language and tries to transcend it. There are strange stories in Buddhist literature of how seekers would come to fill the vacuum in their lives with words and concepts and questions, and how the masters to whom they came would shout at them or even slap them to make them stop evading reality by the use of language. Sometimes they even ordered their students to avoid the great words of their religion, like Buddha and Nirvana, as if they were smut. How odd it must have seemed. But they meant no disrespect. They were trying to blast the novices out of the comfortable verbal retreats into which they had settled down. Zen Buddhism clearly is not so much interested in what people profess, but in their living experience. It claims that to a person who has never known water, no description of it in words can equal being thrown into a lake. So the danger of language as a substitute was in the air 600 years before Christ said, "What is the point of using churchy talk without doing what I tell you to do?" Or, if you want it in modern slang, what he really said was, "Talking won't cut it." But we think it will. And much of our talk is without genuine caring and conviction, or else the words would not come so easily. And I'm going to say something I hope you don't misunderstand. I think churches, church members, preachers use the word God and the word Jesus Too often, too easily, with too much familiarity. I think if we had the depth of feeling, of respect, of awe, we should have, those words would probably come less seldom to our lips. Familiarity. I heard a woman pray on television the other day saying, God, we're just met here in this little place, God, and we know that, God, that you're with us, and God, we want you. As if she were talking to the grocer. Familiarity. How do you like those telephone calls in which someone says, hello, is this Robert Myers? A little breathlessly, I say, yes. Thinking there must be a problem somewhere, an accident. And then, hello, Robert. How are you this evening? Is this a voice I should recognize? Someone I'm supposed to know, since the tone is so familiar, almost endearing? And then it comes, Robert, this is Vicky, and I'm with Aluminum Siding Incorporated. And we'd like to come out and... How shabby to get a foot in the door by pretending familiarity, by sounding as if one actually cares, as if one felt that genuine concern which is meant by Paul's agape love. Even a beautiful voice can be risky when it only increases the deceptive power of words with no love behind them. I had to be in church as a child on Sunday morning and Sunday evening, on Wednesday nights, and on every single night of any 2 or 3 week gospel meeting we had. I sometimes think I must have heard more speakers as a child than anyone ought to have to hear in a lifetime. But I learned some things, and one of them was that the more magnificent a man's voice is, the greater the danger he's in. The seduction of a deep and powerful and melodic voice is that one may not worry about substance, but use the music simply to delight people with the sound of it. When I think of that, I always remember a minister Bob Scott and I knew in Little Rock, whose voice was so rich and melodious and mellifluous that it all but hypnotized an audience. In the words of that man on TV who used to advertise Roman meal bread, it was full of pure golden honey. But by and by, as I listened for something thoughtful, I discovered the man wasn't saying anything at all, and apparently had not said anything for years. He simply plucked the strings of his deep bass cello, and in all that million-dollar sound, there weren't 5 pennies worth of wisdom. There wasn't an iota of real concern for his audience. This is what Paul meant by eloquence without love. Because if that man had loved his audience, he would have studied. What he loved was the sound of his voice and the prophets of his pulpit. And you know, by contrast, the 2 contemporary preachers I would this morning travel most quickly and eagerly to hear are not great orators. One of them has a high, squeaky voice. The other is so shy and diffident in public, you really have to concentrate. But behind each word is wisdom harvested from years of study and shared because they love people. Churches suffer, listen carefully, Tom Orr, because of people who make only verbal commitments. I really do love this church, someone says, but never serves it, never supports it, takes, 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 and drifts along on the warm glow of having said something nice. We all face the temptation to suppose that when we have said something fine, we have actually done something fine. One day, when one of Napoleon's aides was tracing a proposed campaign on a map, Napoleon stopped him with a pointed reminder. He said, "Your finger is not a bridge." He meant, it's easy for you right now to lay your finger across that river on the map, but in reality, it's going to be very hard to build and slow work, and men will die. And don't for a moment forget that in your planning talk. Words are not a highway from here to there. Sometimes heavy construction work has to be done between the thing we say and the deed that fulfills it. The world is not put right by people who use words like generosity and justice and mercy, but by people who show those qualities in action. The best preachers have never stood in pulpits at all. As a perceptive writer of plays by the name of William Shakespeare put it once, action is eloquence. It's the doing that counts. I felt a moment of genuine sorrow when Harry Reasoner died not too long ago because I was a fan of his. I used to watch the Reasoner Report, and I remembered it in connection with this sermon today because of one of the reports that brought all this business of talk versus action home to me in a dramatic way. It featured a couple down in Louisiana who sent 33 kids to the school bus when it pulled up in front of their house. And all 33 kids were theirs, not biologically, but as a result of agape love. They were just a pair who felt that children needed help when everything fell apart around them. So they kept taking in kids. Now, I'll tell you very honestly that when that man talked about what they were doing, when he talked about it, he made me cringe a little because he used every corny expression and every trite phrase in the book. But I watched all those kids being kissed goodnight, and I saw how gladly they responded to the love that man and his wife gave them, and I thought, how trivial my worries are about a man's rhetoric when what he does with his life is so compellingly beautiful. I know people who can spin out sentences so magnificent they make me gasp with admiration. Who wouldn't dream of sacrificing 5 minutes of their time or a nickel of their money? One language, ladies and gentlemen, one language counts. The language of love, ready to act at the right moment. So, if you like to carry out some challenging question from a morning like this. How about these two as we leave? Do all my good impulses die of exhaustion once I've mentioned them to somebody? Do I act, or do I build over and over a substitute world with what can be the cheapest lumber on the market? Words.